Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Okay, picture this. A drawing of a man and a woman in a living room. The woman looking distressed is on the couch with a very large snake coiled tightly around her from nose to waist. The man says, "Oh, he probably just smells your python." If you laughed at that, you have the artist's permission to consider yourself smart and attractive. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New Yorker cartoonist Matthew Diffie. He's been crafting clever works of art and text for the magazine for 15 years, and he has just released a book-length collection of his particular favorites titled Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. Matt, welcome to Think.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. You note that
you forgot the most important part of my bio, which is I'm from Denton, Texas.
You're from Denton, Texas. That's right. You have a Texas background, and there are some Texas elements to your drawings.
Yeah, every now and then.
Yeah.
I try to get it in there.
You've said that you think of yourself as one who draws jokes rather than using the label cartoonist. I don't know if that was a joke of your own or if the distinction really matters.
It's a little bit of a joke, but I mean, the term cartoon or cartoonist is tricky because it can mean so many different things. And what I do is purely like a one joke, one drawing, you know, gag cartooning. So, and I came from a stand-up background, or not that I was successful at it, but I certainly tried it for years and years. So I like to think I'm still writing jokes and I'm just drawing them instead of telling them into a microphone.
There's an interesting, really different way of approaching humor, though. When you're doing stand-up, you're having to set up a whole lot. I guess when you're doing these panels, your setup is with the art.
Yeah, you got to have the drawing do all the work that you would in a, you know, in a setup of a joke. Or in some cases, you can make the drawing do the punchline. If the line is more or less a straight line, and then something in the visual tells the joke. It's a lot different than stand up, but you know the rules of joke writing still apply. I think it's harder than stand up actually,
because you can't know what the reaction's going to be.
Yeah, and you don't get to rely on your timing or your sort of, you know, facial expressions when you deliver it. And you don't have the opportunity to build up like a string of jokes and get a rhythm going, you know, roll the laugh along. People have to look at the cartoon, and really they only spend about 2 seconds looking at it and get all the information, and then you got to zing them with a joke. And that's why sometimes people think, oh, these jokes, you know, cartoons aren't that funny. But it's really hard to get a laugh out loud from a cartoon, at least one standing by itself. But
so you laugh that, you know, people who don't get your humor are not just dumb but also ugly. I know you're being facetious there, but does it feel personal when somebody says, "I don't get that"?
Oh, no, I don't care. I'm doing my best stuff, and nobody's going to get everything. And, you know, I might not be funny to people. But it's definitely a tongue-in-cheek kind of play on what people think of The New Yorker, and especially, you know, when I grew up, I thought, you know, it was not funny and it was elitist and all that stuff. So I'm playing on that, making it a very elite book marketed only to smart, attractive people.
Are there
to George Clooney? Yeah,
George Clooney has 10 copies at home. He gives them out every Christmas.
Yeah.
Are there rules at all about like how highbrow or lowbrow the jokes can be in The New Yorker?
That's a good question. If there are, I'm not aware of it because I certainly do very lowbrow jokes that get rejected from The New Yorker all the time. Let's see. There's more like political correctness, I think, that we have to watch out for. But I definitely do, you know, my share of poop jokes and submit them to The New Yorker. And some of them have got in, actually. There's one in the book, actually, with the two birds.
Right.
High up on, like, the ledge of the side of a building. This is one of my favorite things, by the way, telling a cartoon over the radio. You did a very good job, I have to say. Yeah. So there's two pigeons up on a ledge, and you can kind of see in the background, you're kind of looking from above, so you see sort of the perspective going down to the street. And one of the pigeons is saying, "I'd say my biggest influence is probably Pollock," which is a poop joke, but it's also kind of a high-end art reference. So I guess that one was able to sneak in The New Yorker.
Do you ever throw there's an in-house term we have here. This is a radio station, but we have a television station that is owned by the same company. And sometimes when you're looking to somebody to edit your work, you'll throw in a shot that we call the hairy arm, like a weird distracting shot so that somebody won't notice something you've snuck in elsewhere. Do you ever throw in hairy arm jokes, hoping that something else that you've done will pass muster?
Will pass. Yeah, definitely. You know, they're going to cut the worst ones, so you hopefully get the second worst ones in. But also just, you know, I'm pitching cartoons to the cartoon editor, Bob Mankoff, who's also a cartoonist. And sometimes, you know, I do 10 a week, so I'm only going to sell one on a good week. So some of them are just in there, hopefully, to make Bob laugh. And for him, you know, to remind him that I'm actually funny. Because sometimes, you know, honestly, the New Yorker stuff is a little milder than what I would personally do. Or, I don't know, you know, it's New Yorker funny. So some of them are just in there for Bob to laugh. Or to show my other cartoonists. You know, when I lived in New York for years and years, we would all come in on Tuesdays and, you know, go to lunch afterwards and, you know, show each other our worst cartoons or most outrageous sometimes. It was fun.
People I know that work in public radio will sometimes laugh about the perception of what public radio is and, you know, kind of play with that a little bit in our off time. Does that happen at the New Yorker too?
Yeah, I think there's a strong similarity between the public persona of both organizations. And then the truth is much less fancy and more prosaic, I think. Just, you know, I'm a knucklehead most of the time. So
I was fascinated looking through the book at, and you alluded to this earlier, how many times the drawings really are the straight man in the joke. They're just, you know, a beautiful little line drawing of some scene. Are you always sure that for this particular concept, the pictures should not carry the humor and the text should, or vice versa? Or do you play with that sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect cartoon. The drawing does half the work. Like I said, either the setup or the punchline. I mean, I had a tendency coming from a stand-up background to sometimes just write a joke, like a one-liner, and then just draw a person saying it. And you can get away with that sometimes, but it's not a pure cartoon. And my drawings, you know, there's not a lot of silliness in them. It's pretty straight drawing. I draw things fairly realistically as opposed to cartoony. And I think that comes maybe from Texas, actually, sort of a dry sense of humor where you maybe have absurdity, but you're telling the joke with a straight face. Or maybe Monty Python, that's sort of a big influence of mine. Just, I don't know, I don't like when the cartoons are silly or zany looking. I like it to be a little bit subtle. I guess that's, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's...
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking when I'm drawing. I don't want big facial expressions or... And sometimes that limits me as far as like some wacky ideas that other people can draw, you know, with like a talking, you know, hammer or something. That would be hard for me to draw because I draw realistically.
You do have a fork and a spoon talking to one another.
That's true. I pulled that one off. That was a little bit of an anomaly, but yeah, I have a whole chapter in the book. We should tell people that the book is, you know, obviously for smart, attractive people, but each chapter is a different type of smart, attractive people. So there's a chapter for smart, attractive people in the medical profession, and then smart, attractive lumberjacks, and then that chapter is the smart, attractive people who use utensils.
What's the lumber...
Just to make it really specific.
What's the lumberjack readership of the New Yorker these days?
Oh, I'm sure there's tens.
Metrics?
tens of lumberjacks. And I think they've been overlooked too long with the New Yorker's cartoon books. You know, they always do New Yorker books of, you know, golf cartoons or lawyer cartoons. But the poor lumberjacks, they need to laugh too.
They're providing us all this paper.
Exactly.
Do you, did you realize before you started organizing this way that you find yourself drawn to particular themes with your jokes?
Not as much as I realized when I started putting them together, yeah. I just figured I'd go wherever the joke is. But, you know, if you do it for 15 years and you start looking through everything, you do notice themes. And sometimes it's like a cartoon idea that you worked on, you know, in 1990, in my case, like 98 when I started. And then you didn't quite nail it. And then a year later, you look at it again and push it a little further. And, you know, the same themes come around and you finally, hopefully, get a joke out of them. But sometimes, yeah, it does take years.
Readers have the visual literacy to understand that, like, a person in ragged clothing on a tiny patch of sand with a towering palm tree, that's a person marooned on a desert island. What are the pros and cons of those particular conventions in drawing panels?
Yeah. Well, it's nice because it's like a visual shorthand at this point. Like you just said, you know, it's become recognized. You don't have to do all this sort of backstory of setting up the setting and the characters. It's established at this point, which enables you, I think, to make... wider options of jokes. Like, I mean, I don't know how many desert island cartoons there have been, but hundreds easily. And, you know, there have been so many that you can kind of jump from there to the next step. You don't have to do the first level jokes for that setup. And that was sort of a rite of passion for me when I got in. And I think for the other cartoonists too, you want to add your stamp to that genre of cartoons, kind of build on the tradition. It's harder sometimes when you have to set up a brand new situation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're doing it for the first time, and also people are seeing it for the first time, so they have to sort of understand, okay, this is this situation and these are these characters. And to do that visually is tricky because you're, yeah, you, like I say, you only have about 2 seconds.
And you've only got a few, chances are that there will only be a few square inches of page space. You only get a line or two of copy.
Right.
So are there things that you have worked on until you finally thought, okay, I've solved how I can tell this joke in given the physical parameters that limit how it comes across in the magazine?
I mean, I hope so. But there's always ones where people, you know, you put them in, you think it's completely obvious what the deal is, and people don't get it. I mean, it happens, and that's why sometimes people think the New Yorker is too hard to get, because it's really tricky to get all that across, and sometimes you fail. But you know, at this point, I think I know when I'm... I shouldn't say that, because who knows? I'm sure I fail just as often as succeed, but...
How many cartoonists are there for the magazine?
That's hard to say. I used to say there's about 50, and I think that's still... more or less right, you know, 50 that are in the magazine, you know, a few times a year, and then there's a few more maybe that get one cartoon in and then can't keep it up or you know, fall out of favor for one reason or another. But I would say about 50, and you know, they only pick, we're each doing 10 cartoons, so that's 500 cartoons right there, and there's only about 12 or 15 spots each week.
Have you ever been part of the editing process, like to select?
I have, actually, for other things. I edited a couple books called The Rejection Collection. So that was, you know, just our favorite rejected cartoons. Because, you know, doing it for so long and doing so many cartoons, there's, you know, hundreds and thousands that are still good that didn't get in. And also for another magazine, I was a cartoon editor for a short-termed few weeks, I guess 10 weeks before we decided not to do it. But it's a weird thing, judging comedy. There's no rhyme or reason to it. And that's why you can't take the rejection too seriously, because so many weird factors that you have no control of affect that.
Including the sense of humor of the editor, or there's three other similar themes for submitted that week, that sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly. And often it's, you know, it's the editor's choice, and then he has to take it to the, you know, the top editor or to somebody at the art department. So there's different opinions. And even among cartoonists, you can get a wide range. You know, I early on, I thought it would all be apparent. We'd all agree, you know, what the best cartoon or the best caption was for something. But even among us, there's varying opinions. And like you say, if they get six cartoons about, you know, whatever, selfies, you know, you might have a perfectly good cartoon about it, but they're going to buy it from somebody else, either because the idea is better or because... old Jim over here hasn't sold a cartoon in a while. You know, I mean, there's a thousand things that come into it. Or, you know, the editor's distracted thinking about, you know, his doctor's appointment that he has to go to in an hour, and he doesn't give your cartoon the proper, you know, perspective. Sometimes even like a name that you use, you know, it's when you have to use a name in the cartoon, maybe you use the name Carl, and that reminds him of his uncle, who, you know, has, you know, lung cancer. I mean, there's a thousand different things that come into it. So
this is good that you've got all these ways to process. Like, if it doesn't get bought, you know that it's not a statement on
it.
You, right?
I was like, surely that was a perfectly good cartoon. It just must have had something bad for lunch. Surely it's not my fault. But you can also bring those back and try it a different time, which is something we do a lot.
Change.
Called resubs, resubmissions.
Do you have to label them as such?
Nope. Hopefully he doesn't notice. Hopefully he's forgotten. But he has called me on him a few times. He's like, I've seen this one a few times. But I've also sold cartoons that way. One of my favorites, in fact.
We'll talk about that one in a minute. Yeah, my guest is New Yorker cartoonist Matthew Diffie. His new book is called Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. You can ask a question or tell a story at 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest for the hour is New Yorker cartoonist Matthew Diffie, whose new book is called Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Matt, why does The New Yorker have cartoons? And I'm glad they do. I'm just curious.
That is a very good question. I'm sure glad they do, too. I guess, in my perspective, you know, when I flip open a magazine, I always go zip through looking at the cartoons first. And along the way, you see what stories are laid out and how they look and which ones you're going to go back to read later. For me, that's the function that it serves. But I don't know. That would be a real good question. I should ask my editor that. What do they serve for you? Do you read the magazine, first of all?
I do, and it's funny.
It's not a given.
I love The New Yorker. It tends to pile up and make me feel guilty if I haven't read. Because sometimes you don't even get to everything you want to read because real life gets in the way. But, I think it's great.
When I lived in New York, I loved having the subway ride because that was my excuse to, you know, read for 30 minutes a day. But you miss that when you're in a car. It's not safe.
We do not recommend reading The New Yorker while driving. So we have an email here from Paul in North Branch who wants to know, do you get all the cartoons? You personally, Matt, get all the cartoons in The New Yorker. If you don't, do you ask friends and does that help? And Paul writes, P.S., until I heard you say it, I didn't realize every cartoon in The New Yorker is a joke.
Yeah, that's a fair assumption. No, I do not get them all. This is important for people to know. Nobody gets them all. I don't even think our cartoon editors get them all. You can't. You can't know everything. You can't have, you know, up-to-date references or, you know everything that's being referenced. I mean, often, you know, cartoonists, my peers, you know, will have a cartoon and then I have to call them up. I'm like, wait, I'm missing it. What is it? And then they'll tell me, oh, it's about this new show that's on, you know, Hulu or something. And I'm like, oh, you know, there's just no way to know. And it's not always highbrow references, even though that's the reputation. It's often, you know, like that, some sort of pop culture thing that you're just not aware of.
You were saying
it's impossible. Everybody should give themselves a break. It's okay to not get everything.
You were saying it's hard to get a laugh out loud from a cartoon. I definitely laughed out loud at the one. Do you have the book in front of you?
I don't, actually.
Do you have it memorized?
Okay. I left it at home.
I'll see if I can find it. But it's in the section for jokes for people with tattoos, smart, attractive people with tattoos. Let's see, page 231. And it is just a bunch of hand tattoos that you rarely see.
Oh, yeah. And rarely seen knuckle tats.
Rarely seen knuckle tats. Let me see if I can read some of these as soon as
Because knuckle tats are always like tough, you know, macho things, so...
Right.
And these are the ones you would never see.
So you have like one is, I think, Lutheran.
We should point out like it's the four digits.
Right.
That so you have to have
make
eight,
a fist.
Uh-huh. Like two fists side by side. You make eight letters across the knuckles. Anyway, Lutheran would be a rare one.
Alan Alda is one.
Alan Alda. Somebody who's a big fan of Alan Alda might want to get his name tattooed on there.
Flautist.
Flautist. I just think it would be hilarious to have a... Actually, I think I originally did have that as the idea. It started with that one. Just a person playing a flute, but you can see their knuckles have the word flautist. But it was harder. It was too hard to do because the hands are turning different ways. See, these are the things I wrestle with, trying to draw a cartoon. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, surgeon is another one I like. That there's
surgeon.
Too few letters, but you put a little
heart
on the pinky.
Surgeon.
Oh, heart
yeah,
surgeon. I got
heart,
it.
So he's a heart surgeon with knuckle tats. Wouldn't that be just
Well, they have gloves
scary.
On, so maybe you wouldn't.
That's true. You wouldn't
have to
see
know.
It was fun for me to do stuff like that because I can't really do very many of those things in The New Yorker, like a double page, full sort of multi joke presentation. It's always a single panel in The New Yorker, almost always. So it was nice to put a bunch of that stuff in the book. You know, bigger pieces, I guess you would say.
Are there things you just love to draw?
Well, let's see. For some reason, I love drawing. Not all my characters, but a lot of my characters. Are balding men. I don't know why. And bespeckled balding men for some reason. I don't know. I'll draw cowboys too. What else do I like to draw? Furniture is pretty fun sometimes. Chairs. I guess. I don't know. I like drawing. The truth is I don't like drawing everything. Sometimes the drawing just becomes the work part of it. I do 10 a week, so. Those are just sketch level, but.
I was going to ask you about that because, you know, I've known many really brilliant writers who will say, I kind of hate writing. Like, I have to do it, and I feel like I'm good at it, and I'm happy after I've done it, but it just takes so much mental energy. Is that comparable when you're trying to create art and you're drawing things?
Yeah, it's embarrassing to say, but sometimes it's so hard to just sit down at the drawing table and draw. I know it sounds pathetic.
No.
But when you do it, you know, when you do it all the time and it is work and you have a deadline and it's just, ugh, I got to draw this dog. Ugh. It's ridiculous, I know. It's way, way better than any of the other jobs I've had.
What other jobs have you had?
Oh, man, I've done all kinds of stuff. I was a waiter for a while, waiter for Applebee's. That was the shortest job I ever had. I think I had it 3 weeks.
Could you put that on a knuckle tattoo?
A-P-P-L-E-B-Y
apostrophe S. Yeah, you could do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Or no, it's too easy again.
I did all kinds of like construction work and, you know, I don't know, outdoor work in Texas and North Carolina where I lived later. Humidity was awful. What else did I do? I worked at a sign company. Did those vinyl signs and hand-painted some signs. Cleaning crews.
Were there certain kinds of jobs that actually were good in terms of, like, allowing you to be kind of mindless while you were doing the work?
Yeah. Yeah, the best job I ever had actually was a third shift convenience store clerk.
Ugh.
I would come on, you know, at midnight and work till 7 in the morning.
That's a challenging
schedule. After about 2, it was on the freeway, so after about 2, all I would get is, like, these long-haul truckers and, you know, police officers coming in for coffee. It was the best because I had a stack of books and I had a sketchbook and, you know, I just drank coffee all night and some Slurpees and, yeah, did work and thought and read and drew. It was fun.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by people who have those overnight. It's not the work itself. Like, I guess working in a convenience store could be interesting, but the thought of being up at an opposite time from everyone else sounds hard.
It was nice. I mean, I didn't do it forever. I did it for about 3 years probably. I liked it. I felt like I was a investigative reporter or something, looking into a whole other world. There was a Waffle House on the same exit, so I got to know the Waffle House staff as they'd come over for cigarettes or whatever. It was just, it was this whole nighttime world that I got to see. And talking to truckers, you know, was kind of fun. I enjoyed it.
Have you done a lot of trucker jokes?
Let's see. I'm sure I have. I'm not thinking of it. I should have done a chapter for Smart Attractive Truckers. That'll be in book 2, I guess.
That's right. It's always great to plan for the next volume.
Oh, I did do a cartoon that just popped into my head about sort of convenience stores. It was a scene where outside of a convenience store, and there's a big tanker that's pulled up that says, you know, gasoline on the side, and they're filling up the tanks. You know, they unscrew the thing in the concrete, and they've got a hose going down there. And then there's another truck, equally big, with a hose going into the store, and on the side of it, it says coffee. So they're filling up the coffee from a tanker. That one didn't sell. One of the many.
What do you do with those if they're at the sketch level? So you sketch them and then they get accepted and then you actually put the work into really perfecting the drawing.
Yeah.
But surely you don't throw them away.
No, I've got black binders full of, you know, the rejected cartoons. And like I say, we've been able to put them in these rejection collection books, some of the best ones or some of the rowdiest ones. You know, the idea is that these are all inappropriate for the New Yorker, which is half the fun. But you keep them and, you know, in many cases you look at them years later and sometimes you can add an element or, you know, kind of crack the joke that you half did then. Because, you know, they're not all great, honestly. I mean, obviously, I guess. And then other times you'll look through your old ones and be like, oh, this one was actually good, and you'll bring it back. Oh, I alluded to one of my favorites, actually. So this is one that's in the book. It's a guy sitting in a chair, kind of a rough, maybe a Texan, kind of a tough guy, unshaven. And he's sitting under a sign that says face painting, $5. But then you notice his hand is just holding a painter's roller in a pan. And he's smoking a cigarette. So he's just going to be like, here you go, kid. That one, you know, I submitted and didn't get accepted, you know, probably a couple times. And then I remember my mom, for some reason, saw it, or I had it. I don't know. And she said, oh, I like that one. So I submitted it again, and lo and behold, they bought it. Still one of my favorites.
I like that one because it reminded me of, you know, if you've ever had a friend who says, what do you do? I'm a painter. And people get all excited if they think they're a fine art painter. And then if they say, no, actually, I just, you know, I paint people's houses, everyone goes, oh. Which is, it's also kind of an important job, but just
it's
in a different
important.
Way.
Sure. That's similar to cartoonist or cartoons, because cartoons could be what I do, or they could mean Saturday morning, you know, animated shows or medieval fresco sketches, that kind of thing.
How did you discover that you were good at drawing?
I was always, you know, the kid that was drawing. You know, and I guess always I humbly say, a little better than everybody else. And I humbly because it's not, you know, I had talent that was not my doing. There's plenty of areas where I'm not talented at all. Music, for instance. But yeah, I was a kid at Robert E. Lee Elementary School there in Denton, and I was drawing all the time and, you know, getting attention for it, which made me draw more and got better and better. And yeah, I was just always, it was always pretty clear that I could do it. And I, you know, was encouraged to do it and got better.
If I could do what you did, I think I would never buy anybody a Christmas or birthday gift ever again. I would just make them a panel.
Yeah,
is it way too much work to do that? Oh, you have.
Well, my mom's house is full of paintings that I've given her for every possible occasion. Yeah.
I guess it's good you're not asked to, you know, musicians are asked to play their friends' weddings and, you know, hairdressers, but that probably doesn't happen to you.
No, I do a lot of, like, album covers for musician friends, and I do, you know, I've done logos for people's business. You know, I do a lot of little things like that when I can.
All right, I'm curious about how you kind of visually reduce the world to something that would fit into a line drawing, a pencil drawing of a few square inches. So you're sitting right now, we're not in the same room, you're at NPR West, but you're sitting in a radio studio. If you were going to portray yourself in that studio, what would you have to leave in to tell your audience where you are, and what could you leave out?
Yeah. Well, I'm sitting here, there's a mic on a stand here, like an arm, robot arm looking thing, and there's a bunch of computer screens around me. I don't know that I need those computer screens, and I certainly don't need what's on the computer screens. That would just get too distracting. But I would need the mic. I would need me sitting here with the cans on my ears, the headphones.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of a control panel here. That's probably all I would need. And the NPR logo.
Of course.
It's up on one of the screens.
Maybe
a light that says, there's a light here that says mic, which I would assume, I would probably change it in my cartoon to on the air or something.
Yeah, I guess that's the standard.
It would read immediately as a radio station. Yeah, I guess that. But yeah, it's knowing more what to leave out, I think, in most cases. Like, don't try to draw all the little knobs and all the stuff, because the scale is so small, it would just look like a mess.
When you go back through and you're selecting work for a book like this one, Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People, do your jokes and captions function at all like a diary for you? Do you think, oh, I did that joke about the pigeons inspired by Pollock and at the time that I was moving into my new apartment? Or does that happen to you?
Yeah, not hardly at all for me. But there are cartoonists who would say absolutely yes. Bruce Eric Kaplan, I know, feels like his are sort of a chronicle of where he was in life. Me, not so much. And it's another thing. I rarely get ideas from real life. Like, people are, you know, any sort of situation, people are like, oh, I bet you're getting some cartoon ideas from this. And I never am. I don't know if it's a deficiency. But for me to come up with cartoons, I have to just literally sit down and drum up ideas. I mean, very rarely I'll come up with something that somebody will say in real life or a situation. I'll be like, oh, this kind of is a cartoon. I mean, maybe once a month that'll happen.
I guess that's good, so that the people in your life are not like, thanks for broadcasting that fight we just had.
Yeah, exactly. I'm protecting others. No, I would get ideas that way if I could. I would love to. I'm always needing ideas, so.
Well, Stephen wrote via Twitter. He wants to know if you have writer's block, if you deal with that.
Yeah, I did a cartoon about that. I have an airplane circling in the sky, like farmland below, and the sky is empty. There's nothing in the sky but this tiny airplane. And then the title of the caption is Sky Writer's Block. So he doesn't have anything to skywrite. The writer's block, I mean, I am constantly in writer's block, because cartooning is so idea dependent. It's, you know, you can't start until you have an idea. So I'm constantly without an idea. And that's what I think people don't realize. They think, oh, I can never do what you do. Because they think I just sit down and it flows and it's easy. But, you know, 99% of your time, you're blocked. You got nothing. And you just got to keep thinking and twisting an idea and thinking about different aspects of whatever you're working on until, you know, your little eureka moment happens. And it's a process, and it's work. It's not hard work, but it's work.
Does it help?
So, I would say I'm always blocked.
Does it help to be at a drafting table with pencil in hand at that moment, or does it help to get up and take a walk or ride your bike or whatever?
Well, if you mean like to draw at a drafting table, I don't actually work that way. Some others do, you know, doodle something and then come up with a cartoon about it. I don't do any drawing until I have the ideas nailed down. So I'm always working with just words. I'll picture a drawing as I'm coming up with an idea for sure. And then the walking around, I try to just stay in the seat and try to stay focused on the paper in front of me. I've in the past given myself that excuse, oh, I just need to get out and walk around. I just need to read, or I just need to take a nap. And maybe those would sometimes free me up a little bit, but too often I would end up just reading a book or taking a walk and forgetting that I'm supposed to be working. I've even used, like, I should probably go see a movie. That would really give me some ideas. Watch TV. And I have. If I'm disciplined about TV, I can flip it on for like 1 second, and as soon as I get something that's a new starting point, a new sort of launch into a different direction, because you do need stimulus. You need some sort of assignment in a strange way. Like, you give yourself assignments. Like, I'll sit down and just the first thing that pops into my head, a bookshelf for some reason popped into my head. So I'll start thinking about bookshelves, and then I'll list all the sort of attributes of bookshelves, you know, homemade bookshelves, you know, bookshelves in a bookstore, and then I'll start thinking about books, and then I'll start thinking about coffee. I'll go wherever the stream of consciousness goes, and then if it fizzles out, then I need another bookshelf starting point. And sometimes I'll have a dictionary that I'll flip open, or, you know, occasionally flip, you know, look at something in real life, like a TV, or even Instagram is kind of nice because it's randomness. But I have to fight really hard to not get distracted. I have to, as soon as I get something that I can work with, go back to the paper and stay concentrated effort to brainstorm.
Yeah, the internet is kind of that vortex of attention sucking.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's really changed my life as far as like just the being connected so often. I don't think it's good for me necessarily. I need to shut it off like every third day or something, or maybe most days. I don't know.
We're speaking with New Yorker cartoonist Matthew Diffie. He's got a new book out called Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. Join us at 800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New Yorker cartoonist Matthew Diffie. He's got a new book out called Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, Matt, I'm going to start by asking this. What do you think of the caption contest?
I think it's cool. I mean, there's some other cartoonists who are totally against it. They think it's insulting to our art form, but I'm not that way about it. I think it helps people to realize what we do a little bit.
Like, it's not so easy,
people,
right?
Yeah, well, although, honestly, most of the people I know don't have that reaction, or that I talk to, they're like, oh, mine was good, mine was great. I'm sure that wasn't, but people are enamored by their own ideas, especially when you're starting off. I mean, I've recently looked at like some of the cartoons I did in my first year, and they're just terrible, but I was so convinced that they were brilliant at the time. You know, the more ideas you do, the more you realize how bad some of them are, I guess. But I'm all for the caption contest. It's fun. People get to do what we do, or half of what we do, at least.
Do you ever submit empty, blank, uncaptioned panels for that purpose?
No, I've taken my name out of the hat, out of the ring. What's the word? I don't know. I've taken my name off of that list of people who do that, just because it's not usually done that way. In my experience, I've done three of them, and it's always I turn in a cartoon, like a full cartoon with a caption and everything, and they say, okay, we're going to buy this cartoon for the caption contest.
Oh, that's got to be a blow.
So it's like they take your caption off of it. So it's getting accepted and rejected kind of at the same time. So I just don't like feeling like that. It makes me feel sad. So I don't do the caption contest anymore, although I probably should, because you do get paid the same amount. But
can you make the same? I mean, can you make a living if you sell one cartoon a week to the New Yorker?
Yeah. Yeah, especially if you don't live in the most expensive cities in the world, which I, for some reason, have a habit of doing. Yeah, you can do fine. And there's also, you know, the Cartoon Bank, which is a place that people can get reprints, so you get some residuals after, out of it, too. So it's good. I mean, the problem is you don't know for sure that you're going to sell every week. If you did, that would be a different story. So that's the risky part of it. But I've lived risky freelance all my life, pretty much. You know, I've had day jobs, but I've always been, you know, trying to do art of some form or another. I have to say, it's really fun to know I'm talking to Texans right now. I miss Texas so much. Maybe not right this time of year, but...
You come back in October. It's gorgeous here.
Yeah, exactly. Or springtime. I love springtime in Texas.
Do you still have family here?
No, I don't. But I was in Austin for a couple years ago. I was in New York for 12, and then we moved to Austin for two. Loved it. But my wife thought it was too hot, and she was right. But she's used to Southern California, where you can go outside in the evenings, and it's cool. But Texas is different. You just got to live in air conditioning for a while. I miss the food, mostly. It's lunchtime there, right?
It's lunchtime here. I never eat at work because I'm working through lunch.
Oh, that's a shame. If I was there, I would eat barbecue. I would eat every time I go back, I eat barbecue and Tex-Mex nonstop, and then I feel horrible. But I still do it.
You shouldn't feel horrible. If it's a limited exposure to Tex-Mex, it's probably not so bad for you.
But when it's like 6 days solid every meal, it gets you.
Yeah.
My age, anyway. But I do miss it.
So when you put something in the magazine, do you like still get excited about opening it up and seeing it in print, or do you know what it's going to look like?
Both, I guess. I mean, I do know more now about what it's going to look like as far as, you know, because I turn a cartoon and I work in dark pencil, but they always darken it a little bit. The art department makes it a little zippier, which makes it look cooler. And also seeing it reduced down, because my originals will be like 10 or 12 inches across, or 8 inches. And then in the magazine, you know, they're like 4.5. So that does change it. I mean, I plan for the image to be that size, so I'm not too surprised. But you know, it's still a thrill. You know, the first cartoon that was in there, for sure, I would go to the newsstand and I would, you know, grab a news, you know, turn to page whatever, 78, and I'd see it there. And then I'd walk by the next newsstand and I'd look again to make sure it's in all the copies. And
were you just waiting for someone to say, well, that's a funny cartoon?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I used to do that on the subway, or I didn't used to do it. One time on the subway, I was standing and there was a guy sitting right in front of me and he was flipping through the issue and I knew I had a cartoon coming and he was on whatever, page 40, and it was on page 7, and he was flipping really slowly and I was like, come on. And I actually stayed on the train. I missed my stop so that he would get to the cartoon and look at it. And, you know, sure enough, he flips to page 78 and kind of reads it and he goes, that was it. <He's> like, moving on. It was quite a letdown, but I guess that's the proper reaction to a cartoon. Most people just kind of,
Do you get mail from people?
I have over the years. I haven't gotten any in a while. Maybe they're holding it from me, but mostly I get negative mail. I guess that's what's shown to me. Some people are offended by a cartoon or something. It's impossible not to offend people. I did a cartoon about the Girl Scouts. This is actually a surprising cartoon that I'm surprised the New Yorker bought it, because it was one of those ones I think I just put in there to be rowdy and to make my cartoon editor laugh. So I have a couple of Girl Scouts, or maybe they're even like, what's the lower than Girl Scouts? Like the first, they're Girl Scouts.
Brownies.
Brownies, that's what it is. And so they're going to the door, and somebody's opened the door, and one of the girls is saying, "Would you like to buy some Girl Scout crack?" Which is kind of a rowdy joke. But I was saying, okay, let's take the most wholesome thing and mix it with the worst thing they could be selling. And also, it's sort of like Girl Scout cookies are kind of like crack in a little bit. So anyway, I got a lot of Girl Scouts writing in, upset about that one.
Wow.
Justifiably so, I suppose.
I don't know. I mean, I guess there's always this question of, you know, with humor, like when do you say to somebody, it's a joke, and when do you have to think really seriously about, you know, what it actually means?
I mean, I don't do material that's intending to push buttons like that, you know, but sometimes you have to have a little bit of an edge to it, a little bit of a surprise. And to get a surprise, you have to be a little a little rowdy sometimes. It's a fine line, but I certainly don't intend to push people's buttons or be mean.
Your jokes seem to be not particularly time sensitive. Is that important to you, that,
yeah,
that what's funny now is going to be funny in 25 years?
It is. It's very important to me, actually. I try to avoid doing a joke that'll only be funny, you know, that week that topic is in the news. Because for one thing, if you do that joke and you don't sell it, you really feel like you wasted your time. But then if you do it and you sell it and then you want to put together a book, you can't put those jokes in that book unless you put a little sub, you know, a little statement at the bottom. This time in the news, this was happening, so this was very funny. But yeah, I try to avoid topical stuff just for that reason. I want it to be timeless.
Most of the people that you draw, at least the people that appear in this book, are white people. And you mentioned you like to draw, like,
yeah,
white guys, balding white guys with glasses or whatever. Do you feel like you have to be more careful if you're drawing a person of a different race, just so that you don't do anything that could be construed as the joke being based,
right,
on that difference?
It's tricky. Yeah, I'd like to try. I do try to put in minority characters as often as possible. But like, you know, like we talked about earlier, people are trying to get all the information in 2 seconds. And if a character is, you know, a different type enough to make them notice it, sometimes they think that that's what the joke is about, and you get in trouble even when you didn't intend to. There's several, you know, minority characters in the book. You know, a doctor that's a black guy, which I like doing. I like doing it when I can and when it's not distracting from the joke, like we said.
So you're accustomed to having editors say, okay, we'll take this one, we don't want these four, work on this one, whatever. Is there someone, though, like if you show your wife something that you worked really hard on and she's like, that's not funny, is that more irritating to you?
My wife doesn't think anything's funny that I do. So
really?
I suppose that's good and bad, but I don't care, really. I'm making so many that I just got to keep moving. I don't get bogged down. I mean, it hurts for a second. I'm like, oh, that one was funny. I know what when I've done it and when I haven't done it. I think more than hearing from other people, having done it for so long. Although that might change, because I used to think I was being real funny in my first year, and I look back now and I definitely was not. It hurts a tiny bit when somebody doesn't think it's funny, but not too much, because you're moving on. You got too many ideas to worry about a few of them. I like to think it's like a mother sea turtle. You know, you just dump a bunch of eggs and then you swim back into the sea and let them fend for themselves.
You've got a panel here of, it's a woman, like a crusty old diner waitress, and she's got two people at her table, and one's wearing like a Breton striped shirt and a beret, and the other one is wearing a 10-gallon hat. And so she asks them, let me guess, you want French and you want ranch.
Yeah.
It's very funny. But I'm wondering if, like, if that woman's face, if you've used her as a kindergarten teacher, and if in your mind you have little games that you play with yourself and you've used the same characters and put them in different places.
No, I have not done that, but the way you described it is perfect. That's what I was trying to get across, sort of a veteran, you know, diner waitress who's a little exasperated with it all and just like, ugh, yeah, let me guess. And I've drawn her, or a type of her, you know, several times. I don't know if they're all in the book, but yeah, I don't think you would put that same face on a school teacher, because, I mean, unless the school teacher was the same character type, an exasperated school teacher who's been doing it forever, which I guess you could definitely do cartoons about that. But usually my school teachers are younger for some reason. I don't know why. They're still optimistic. But that the cowboy hat cartoon, I mean, for me, it's about cowboy hats. The cowboy hats are really hard to draw, I've learned. I've worked really hard at it. It's trickier than you would think, especially if you're trying to make them realistically. Can I tell another? That, to me, that's like a Texas cartoon, but can I tell another cartoon?
Sure.
Texas cartoon? Because I left out Texas cartoons. I have a bunch of them, and I could have done a chapter for Smart Attractive Texans, but I think I'll do a different
book. That's a whole book on its own.
That's a whole, exactly, yeah. So one of my favorites, this is because, you know, I was a Texan living in the Northeast for so long, so it tickled me particularly. It's a guy, kind of a twerpy-looking weakling type, and he's wearing glasses. He's kind of a thin guy, and he's got a black eye now, and he's got a busted lip, and his glasses are broken. Clearly, he's been beat up, and he's wearing a T-shirt that says, "Don't mess with Connecticut." It's one of my favorites. I loved that they put that in the magazine. Gave me a chance to... Because they also took one where I had a... I think this one might be in the book, a sort of a Southern breakup cartoon, if you can have such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy's in overalls and he's depressed, and the woman looks like a Daisy Duke type is saying, I hope we can still be cousins. So I had one that made fun of Southerners and Texans, and then one that made fun of the Northeast. Got to have balance.
You know, the Don't Mess with Connecticut one, I think anybody from Texas would get it. I wonder if people in other parts of the country aren't as aware of that little tagline. And that would be one
it's
that...
It's pretty popular. Don't Mess with Texas is worldwide famous, I think. but I'm sure that's a good example, though. I'm sure there were some people who didn't get that. But I think it makes the people who get it even more. Or appreciate it even more. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's the way I think about it. Like, I don't want to dumb things down to where the point where everyone gets it. And I don't even know how I would in that case. I mean, I could have somebody standing beside him that says has a shirt that says, don't mess with Texas, and he's all tough. And then the other guy was wearing, don't mess with Connecticut, and he's all beat up. I guess I could have done that. But I don't want to make it easier in a way.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the reputation that the New Yorker has. And maybe that's why my book is called For Smart, Attractive People. But I think people enjoy it more if they feel a little engaged in getting the joke, you know, if they do half the work.
How much That's people watching do you do? And what is your process for people watching?
I hold a newspaper up and I peek over the top. No, I guess I do it as much as everyone. You know, airports are good for that, you know, sitting watching people and seeing what they wear. Because, I mean, as a cartoonist, we're responsible for all of that. We're responsible for sort of casting the characters by how we draw them and what they wear and how their hair looks, you know. And we try to, it has to all fit the joke. And so we're like, you know, at once we're like the casting director and the costume designer and the script writer, for that matter, and the director, I guess, because you don't want your characters overacting. That's very important. So, yeah, it's the more you can observe real life is better.
Do you have sounds weird, but like a cartoonographic memory? If you see a face or an outfit and you think, I want that, do you need to make a sketch of it or will you remember it?
I think I do have a pretty good visual memory. I notice sideburns or, you know, postures or whatever and what they sort of nonverbally say and file them away. Costumes too, I guess. But I also do, you know, the Google image search when I need to get something right. I did a cartoon, I also can't remember if this is in the book, but this is definitely a Texas-influenced cartoon. Bunch of banditos in the desert. I don't know how to deliver it without giving it away, but the caption is, the Vesperados. So all these banditos are riding Vespas. And I definitely had to Google Vespas to draw them correctly.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that and hope that the Texas Smart Attractive book for Texans will come out soon. Matthew Diffie is a cartoonist for The New Yorker magazine. His current book is Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart Attractive People. Matt, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for making this time for us.
Well, thank you, Chris. This was really fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Jose Carrion. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. On Twitter, I'm at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.